Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
With you this evening, have a chance to talk a little bit about fulfilled prophecy. We'd like to look this evening at three passages in Scripture and examine these. I think we find a very striking phenomenon in the Bible, which, to my knowledge, we do not find elsewhere in literature. And that is not only a claim to predict the future, you do have that occasionally in other writings, but I think a writing that actually can produce the goods. I suppose it's always been known throughout history that predicting the future is a very shaky business. Nobody has made it on the stock market or been able to give anyone a system by which they can make it. Men have gone for centuries to fortune tellers of various sorts, usually with results ranging from fairly good to fairly disastrous, and seeming to be randomly apportioned. Recent discoveries, certainly in the areas of physics, would seem to suggest that not only is the problem of predicting a future merely an unbelievably complicated problem, where in Newtonian physics, theoretically, you could locate all particles in the universe and see which way they're going and at what speed, and in principle, you could predict all the future, given that the assumption that the whole universe is merely a matter of particles moving around. Discoveries in this century, which fall under the category of quantum mechanics, suggest that it is, in fact, with the equipment that we have to observe, that is to say, our eyes, the need of using particles which have energy, whether they be elementary particles such as protons or electrons, or whether they be a weightless particle such as a photon, that in fact all of these particles, when we are trying to locate an object with them, they impart some energy to the object that you bounce them off of. And the result is, you know where the particle was when the thing bounced, but you have disrupted its movement. Or, if you measure its movement, you don't know where the particle is exactly. And this is a very small phenomenon. It's not a phenomenon that's very big. But in fact, it completely ruins any attempt in principle to be able to discover what the future would be by means of observing the phenomena around you and trying to calculate all of the motions of the particles. Nevertheless, the Bible doesn't claim to have that sort of information. It claims to have information about the future from someone who would not be bound to use light or other electromagnetic radiations or various other forces to find out where things is, but one who is in fact in control of these things and therefore can tell us what's going to happen. Well, the three passages we'd like to look at then tonight. In the book of Hosea, chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, another passage from the book of Jeremiah, chapter 22, verses 28 to 30, and a third passage from the book of Daniel, and actually the better part of two chapters. Those will be the three passages we want to look at. Now, we want in this to try and operate with passages that would be satisfactory from an apologetic viewpoint. That is, passages that do not depend drastically upon assumptions about the date of these different books that not everyone would be willing to concede. Many people date the book of Daniel, for instance, at about 168 BC, although the book itself would claim to have been dated 530, maybe, something on that order for the later parts of it. Prophecies that would be made that apparently would be fulfilled between those two dates, someone would claim, indeed, this is no prediction, it's something after the fact. It's easy to predict the future when it's already happened, you know. So it wouldn't be hard to write a prediction of the Second World War today. And then if you could pawn that off as having been written in 1600, that would look very impressive. Well, so the sorts of things we need then to recognize a fulfilled prophecy, the first one would surely be that the prediction would be known to have been made in advance of the fulfillment. That's pretty straightforward. Secondly, the fulfillment should be fairly easily recognized. You ought to be able to tell when the event has occurred that that is indeed a fulfillment prophecy. It may not be that the thing is exactly what you expected, but if you go back to look at the text and it turns out indeed it is what the text says, it falls within the range of the meaning of the text, then that's worth something. So the fulfillment should, in fact, be recognizable. Naturally, you would be suspicious if the prophet or his helpers had any great part to do with the fulfillment of the prophecy itself. I can predict for you that I will be preaching tomorrow at Faith Bible Church, and that might not be so, but I'm going to do my best to do that, and the result would be you would not be greatly impressed if, in fact, that prediction came true. So there would be a prophet, if you like, involved in the fulfillment of his activities. Likewise, if a prophet made a prediction and he had a bunch of followers who went out and set out to fulfill it, that wouldn't be too impressive either. It would be fulfilled prediction, but nothing more spectacular than a person setting out to go to college and get a degree, and then he gets one. Fourthly, the prediction should be far enough away from the fulfillment, or it should be detailed enough that it isn't reasonable that the person has just made a guess. Obviously, you can always say, well, it was a good guess. But if you get a complicated enough prediction, that begins to look difficult. And if you get many examples, that begins to look much more difficult. So we're talking about something here, not something that would have deductive certainty, but something that would have a inductive, convincing nature. A prediction that we can show from historical evidence was made before the fulfillment, that it's recognized when in fact it occurs, that the prophet himself has not done it or some follower, and that the prediction is far enough away from the fulfillment, or it's detailed enough that you really cannot reasonably say it was a guess. Let's look then at the first of the passages we want to consider, Hosea chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. There's the way the passage reads. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without a king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Now, the passage we have here comes from the book of Hosea. Hosea contains a number of different materials, but a very important theme in the book of Hosea is the relationship between the prophet Hosea and his wife Gomer. Hosea was, according to his own statements, asked to do a very peculiar thing by God. He was asked to marry prostitutes. And that certainly is an unusual command. One would want to be fairly sure that it was God talking under those circumstances, but apparently Hosea had sufficient evidence to satisfy himself on that regard. Hosea was told that his life would be an acted parable of God's relationship to Israel. And since when God took Israel out of Egypt, out of captivity, and brought them up, they were already worshiping false gods. So it is only reasonable then to represent that since the marriage bond here is going to represent the bond between God and Israel, so a unfaithfulness to the marriage bond, even in advance of the marriage, would be reasonable, and that is what we see then. Well, he marries the woman. They have some children, or she has some children. Perhaps some unclarity as to who is the father in certain cases, but that's the situation. These children are given certain symbolic names of God's reaction to Israel's activity, that they have sinned in certain ways, and God will bring their sin upon them, name the place where it will happen, and names one of the kids for this place. Another one, that God will not continue to pity this nation, and so he names one of the girl not pitied. And then finally, that as this situation continues and the unfaithfulness continues, one of the children is named Not My People, because God is going to reject his people for a time, and this is acted out in the name of the child, and then Gomer apparently leaves. Abandons Hosea, goes away, should presumably represent some kind of a break. Then, Hosea finds Gomer later, I don't know how much later, in a slave market, buys her back, brings her back to the home, and there at the beginning of chapter 3 of Hosea, Hosea is told by God what to do. With regard to Gomer, he is to take her back. It's his wife, but under a rather peculiar situation. He is to have no relations with her for some time. But he is to see to it that she has no relations with any other men during that time. And then he will receive her back. And this then, verses 4 and 5, is given as the explanation of what that part of the acted parable means. that God is going to cause the nation Israel to be in a circumstance in which they will be for many days without a king or prince, without a government, and without a kingship, prince here, as I said before, but for those of you who weren't there, a government official. Without a king, without a government official. And yet, both the government of Israel as a whole, that is, that Moses governed and that the judges governed and such, that was set up by God. He had, by revelation, given them a government. And after some time, he had, by revelation, made that government to be a monarchy, after Saul, under one family, David. One dynasty, David. But he says there will be a time of many days, that's rather vague, but quite a long time, in which the Israelites won't have a king, they won't even have a government official. That they will also be for a long time without sacrifice. And that's probably the strangest statement of all. Here is a religion set up in which sacrifice is the principal feature, you might say, of access to God. That every access, all the forgiveness in this system has to do with the shedding of blood. And the entrance into the most holy place of the temple can be taken only once a year. That the person is only the high priest who can go. He cannot enter the place unless he has sacrificial blood to sprinkle upon the Ark of the Covenant, which is located inside the most holy place. And yet, after God has set that all up, here's a prediction that there won't be any of that for some period. There will not also be a sacred pillar, and that's an ambiguous term. Sacrifice was something commanded by Scripture, and so would obviously be a connection with the Mosaic religion. The sacred pillar is ambiguous because there were sacred pillars in the temple itself, at least so we'd understand, sitting on the front porch of the temple, and there was also a use of sacred pillars by the Canaanite religion, and so it had both good and bad connotations. They would be without ephod for some time. An ephod is kind of a, some type of device that hooks around the fellow's shoulders. I don't know what you would call exactly a open jacket or something that opens on the sides. And this particular device had kind of a plate made of 12 stones. It was worn by the high priest, so they would be without ephod. The word is also used occasionally for a priestly dress, once in a while, for somewhat stranger use. But pretty generally, it's connected with Mosaic religion. We have the high priest wearing an ephod. We have the little kid Samuel wearing some other kind of ephod that a child who was in the temple would wear. And then at one point back in the Old Testament account, you have the fellow Gideon made an ephod to commemorate his victory, and this became a source of idolatry at a later time. So it's some kind of a jacket or maybe a little short poncho of some sort, and there was a special one that was worn by the high priest. So it seems to be pointing again at priestly features. The religion perhaps is a little broader. And then the last word, teraphim, or household idols, is quite definitely a negative term, a term of something that was actually forbidden in Scripture. So that the verse 4 of Hosea chapter 3 tells us two rather peculiar things then. It tells us on the one hand that the Israelites will have no government for some period of time. There will be no king, there will be no prince. No king, no prince. But it will still apparently continue to be a nation in some sense because they will be able to return later. You see the next sentence say. But then this very peculiar feature, that they will be without the religion that God had established at Sinai, but they will also be without idolatry. Very, very strange set of statements. And yet that is the situation that we have in the biblical account. There will be no government and no Davidic kingship. There will be no Sinai religion, but there won't be any idolatry. But after that, they will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. So apparently there will someday be a kingship after that time. Now, Book of Hosea is usually dated around the time of Isaiah, about 700 B.C., sometimes dated a little bit earlier than that. One might argue that it, in fact, was actually written later than that, although I don't know that there are many people that place it a lot later. But what about the fulfillment of this? Has there been anything in history to correspond to a fulfillment of this? Some might claim, well, this is a statement of what happened at the Babylonian captivity, that Israel was out of their land for a short period of time, 50 to 70 years, that they therefore did not have any official government, they did not have any king, and they were in Babylon, and so they did not continue their sacrifices, and there was no high priest who was actually functioning. Well, there's some problems with that, though that might well be claimed by some people as the as what this is all about, and therefore it's not a real prediction. The book of Hosea was really written about, say, 300 B.C., and since we don't have any manuscripts that early, it would be hard to disprove that it might have been written that early. But if you look at the situation in the Babylonian captivity, that does really not seem to fit at all. The king of Israel, Jeconiah, was taken away by the Babylonians before the city of Jerusalem was ever destroyed, by about 10 years. He was taken off from Jerusalem into Babylon in 597 B.C., and the city was not destroyed until about 587. Jeconiah continued to be recognized as rightful king by all the Israelites, and in the only documents we have from Babylon that say anything about the fellow, he is recognized as king. Well, apparently, neither the Babylonians nor the Jews ceased to recognize this fellow as king, and he lives through a good bit of the captivity, and then a son and a grandson, and when his grandson returns from captivity, he is operating as the governor of Judea, and apparently then he had some recognition all through this period. So it looks like that although they did not actually have a nation in their own homeland, yet there was some sort of a government maintained, a king in exile and such, all through this Babylonian captivity period. There is some evidence that the incidence of idolatry has begun to fall off before the end of the Babylonian captivity, but during a good bit of that time, there are some problems with idolatry. For the people who remain in Palestine for another 10 years, they certainly are very heavily involved in idolatry. We see in the book of Ezekiel. We see in the book of Jeremiah that another group after 587, besides that having assassinated the person who was acting as governor in Palestine, that they will run off to Egypt, and they are quite obviously still involved in idolatry. The information we've got is that there was still a substantial amount of idolatry among the Israelites during this captivity period. So they come back. It does not look like anything that a writer 100 years afterwards or such could have described in these terms. But what is very striking is when we come some hundreds of years after the time of Hosea, and some hundreds of years after we know the book of Hosea must have been in existence before 200 B.C., we have had the Hebrew Old Testament, particularly the Minor Prophets, which we're concerned with here, has been translated into Greek, and we in fact have a scroll of the Hebrew Minor Prophets from before the time of Christ. We actually have a substantial amount of the material, of the manuscript, going back before the time of Christ. So this material was written down, available in Greek and in Hebrew both, and after a while transmitted by two different groups, already by the time of Jesus Christ. Now, what is very interesting is that in 70 AD, the Jews had revolted against what was then the Roman Empire. They had actually revolted in 66. There was a long siege, and the city was taken. In the course of this activity, the government was destroyed, and you do not have a national Palestinian-Israeli government after this period. I suppose one might argue that the Sanhedrin functions, and that runs a little bit further on. But certainly by 135 or so, you have a disruption of that situation. Any kind of Jewish government in Palestine gradually fizzles out. There's been no king, no Davidic king, from the time of the first Babylonian captivity. No one is allowed to retake the throne when they come back. There has been a series of Maccabean kings from about 140 B.C. to about 60 B.C. There have been a couple kings who would call themselves kings of the Jews. The Jews weren't too enthusiastic about one of them, under the name of Herod, for a period of perhaps 45 years, adding up to two reigns, one right before the time of Jesus and one early in the middle of the first century. But from there on, you have a situation where the Israelites do not have a government, they're scattered over all the nations, they cease to practice sacrifice for the destruction of the temple, although it's not clear that that was necessary that they do that, and therefore they have no high priest. The ruling high priests were apparently assassinated at the beginning or early in the revolt, about 68 A.D., and the line was apparently lost, so that no one makes any real claim to the high priesthood after that time. There is then no pillar, since there's no temple, and there's no pillar in the sense of idolatrous activity, and there is no teraphim, no household idols either. You come into a period, by the time you get beyond the New Testament period, where the Israelites have settled down to a form of religion that is different from that of the Old Testament, and that has removed this whole aspect of sacrifice that no longer finds central place. It has removed the whole liturgy associated with the temple and tries to function on what is left. Certainly a very strange situation, unusual that a group will change their religion entirely and yet claim to hold to the same documents, and yet here it was very clearly predicted in the biblical material. So my suggestion here is that for the first verse of this passage, we indeed have a fulfilled prophecy. The sons of Israel will remain for many days without king, without government official, without a sacrifice, without a sacred pillar, without an ephod, without household idols. It does say, however, that there's going to be a change sometime in the future. And this has certainly not been fulfilled to date. The sons of Israel have returned in the sense that they have come back to the land. That's a very striking thing in itself, that a group of people who had a homeland for 1,500 years were uprooted from it for nearly 2,000 years, but they did not cease to exist as a entity. They weren't a national entity. They didn't have a organized government, but they did not cease to exist as a recognizable entity. And they've begun to return to their land in very large numbers. We have perhaps a fifth of the Jews in the world now settled in Palestine. We have this situation. The sons of Israel will return. One can argue whether they have yet sought the Lord their God. Orthodox Jews would disagree with me in feeling that that they have already done that perhaps, and I would say yet they have not done that. There's a reference here to seeking David their king. Sounds like some sort of a restoration of the kingship. This has been commonly understood by the rabbis as the coming of the Messiah. A picture of the afterward, a return of Israel. We certainly see that happening. We see other events here which would be said to be after that. So we should not be surprised that that might not be fulfilled yet. And you find this basic theme throughout the scriptural material. Some materials have very definitely been fulfilled. Some materials that the Bible seems to place in an eschatological framework, the coming of the Messiah, the last disasters upon Israel, the intervention of God to deliver them, things of that sort, they've not happened. But we shouldn't say, well, that means that the Bible's prophecy is not fulfilled. We're not claiming that all the Bible's prophecies have been fulfilled, because all of the period of history which the Bible speaks about has not yet passed over. But the point here is that we have a very definite and peculiar prophecy here, which was in existence before the time of Jesus, and yet that's nearly 100 years before the events that we see here in verse 4 begin to occur. Well, we need to move on here. We'd like to look secondly at this prophecy regarding a fellow who we had mentioned once offhand here in our previous discussion of the Hosea passage, and that was King Jeconiah. In the book of Jeremiah, chapter 22, verses 28 through 30, we have a very striking statement made regarding the king who was at that time ruling in Palestine. Jeremiah, living during the last days of the southern kingdom of Israel, has this remark in Jeremiah chapter 22. Is this man, Coniah, kind of a nickname for Jeconiah, a despised shattered jar? We don't think much about shattered jars now, but in a period when everything was made of pottery, the common sort of trash to see around that was used for paving roads and filling in holes and things like that were broken pieces of pottery. Is this man, Jeconiah, a despised shattered jar? Is he an undesirable vessel? Why have he and his descendants been hurled out and cast into a land they have not known. Oh, land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down as childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. This is a rather unusual sort of prophecy, because what we're hearing at this passage is that this man, called Coniah or Jeconiah, is going to be taken out of his position as king over Israel, and yet he is a descendant of David, and God told David, you won't lack a man to sit upon the throne. Your kingship, your dynasty will last forever. And now he tells this fella, Coniah, or Jeconiah, or Jehoiakim, three different ways of handling this fella's name. They're all slight varieties of the idea that God is the one who establishes. And this fellow comes right down the line of the kings of Judah. He's right on the sequence through which all the kings come. David, Solomon, Rehoboam, et cetera, on down, Manasseh, Ammon, Josiah, Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim. And he is carried off 597 B.C. off to Babylon. He still retains his title king, but his uncle, Zedekiah, actually about the same age, is put in place of him as kind of a regent, and he remains as ruler then in Palestine for the next 10 years until he tries to revolt, and then he is carried off also. Now the interesting thing here then is that this prophecy would seem to put a curse on the royal line of David, a line from which other passages in Scripture say the Messiah is going to come, who's going to reign forever. And some people would handle this by saying, well, it's just an inconsistency in Scripture. There were different writers at different times in Scripture, and they said different things, and of course they contradict. But when you actually look down in Jeremiah himself, you find that 5 verses later, he is in fact saying that the descendant of David, the royal descendant of David, is going to be the Messiah. Behold, the days are coming, he says in Jeremiah 23:5, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely. And this is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. So here's a statement regarding a branch of David being raised up, Messiah apparently, and reigning in righteousness. And yet, how is that going to be? Here we have the descent, and it would appear that this line has been cursed. Well, one could say, well, maybe he just decided to shift over to another line. I suppose you could argue that, but there seems to be a very definite royal line, which runs down through here. Is there any other way God could handle that? Has he not done something that will make it very difficult to solve the whole problem? Can he keep his promise to David? And can he keep his statement regarding a curse upon the line of Jeconiah? Well, it's interesting to look at a peculiar phenomenon in the New Testament. And that's a fact that Jesus, who is presented as Messiah, who is presented in the New Testament as claiming to be Messiah, that we have two different genealogies for this fellow Jesus. One of them is given in the Gospel of Matthew. One of them is given in the Gospel of Luke. The Matthew genealogy is rather interesting because it's this very same line. David, Solomon, Rehoboam, I'm going down here, Manasseh, Ammon, Josiah, Jeconiah, the very person who's been cursed, comes on down, Jacob, Joseph, and Jesus. A genealogy which contains this very person cursed, of whom it is said, no man of his descendants shall prosper sitting any more upon the throne of David. When we look over in Luke, though, we find another genealogy. This genealogy also comes from David. It does not come down the royal line, however. But it goes off by another son, David. Nathan runs down, does not come through Jeconiah, comes down to Eli, and then Joseph, although Joseph in the statement seems to be constructed in such a way that it might not be understood that he was actually in the line. and then down to Jesus. There have been various attempts to explain how these two lines are consistent with one another. Some have suggested that this is actually Mary's genealogy, and I kind of prefer that myself, although I have no way of knowing that that's the case, and the other that this is Joseph's genealogy. Some have suggested that somewhere along the line, institution in Jewish circles of levirate marriage took place, the situation by which when a person died without any descendants, if he had a younger brother, that younger brother was, if he was able to, supposed to marry the widow, and the first child of that union would be counted as the child of the brother who had died, since he had had no issue, would become the son of the brother who had died, rather than the son of the brother who remained. We don't know what the explanation for these two different genealogies are, but it's very interesting. One of them comes down, and it would not fall under the curse. My suggestion is it is actually Mary's genealogy, and Jesus is actually a son of Mary. According to the biblical accounts, Jesus is not a son of Joseph, except by adoption. It's called father in that case by adoption, but the accounts make quite clear that he is not really a son of Joseph. So that would give you a rather peculiar situation over here, that Jesus would be a son of David by birth, and so might qualify for the Messiahship in some sense. He would be adopted into the royal line, and so would qualify legally for rulership, should there ever be a restoration of a line. But because he's not an actual son through this line, there's no reason why the curse should apply to him. And so you have a very peculiar situation, which one can say, well, somebody just sat down and hoped it up in New Testament times. Well, there's no way to absolutely prove that was not so, but it's very interesting that this feature of these prophecies are worked out in a rather striking way, and yet I don't know that people have really noticed that. An example of rather trivial sorts of things, and yet a way in which God would be showing his control. Who comes to birth at a certain time, who would be eligible for the throne, things of that nature. That one, I think, we can say there is something strange there, but it would be difficult at this point to prove that that must have been a fulfillment. One could say, well, the New Testament writers have just been very clever. You do find quite consistently, though, a problem in the attempts of men to discredit the New Testament of getting into a bind between the cleverness of these guys and the foolishness of these men. They will find all sorts of things that they say, these are obvious contradictions, but then they are faced with other problems where they say, look how cleverly this certain thing was disguised. It's very interesting that they will say, Jesus never claimed to be Messiah, or Jesus never claimed to be God, or anything of that sort, and yet they have a great difficulty in figuring out how that material actually got into the record. We're going to try and spend some time looking at that tomorrow night. We'd like to look last at Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Two prophecies, one of which, according to the book of Daniel, was given to the ruler of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. In Daniel chapter 2, we're told that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he wanted to get an interpretation of dreams. Not a strange thing for ancient times. Called in his wise men, the guys who are supposed to be in the business of interpreting dreams, and he said, interpret my dream for me. And they said, sure, king, tell us what the dream is. He said, how about we do it this way? If you guys can really interpret my dream, I'll know that by your ability to tell me what the dream was. And the wise men were very much shaken up at this point, because that kind of put their reputation on the line. And it's very easy to interpret dreams if somebody tells you what they are, because if you're careful in how you word things, you can hardly be proven wrong. Well, it depends on what the dream is. But you can figure out some way of interpreting in such a way that you leave plenty of room for yourself, although it makes you look like you're saying something, but you're not really saying something. Surely all of us have an opportunity to find that by reading the astrology columns in the newspaper. Material that is cleverly constructed to look like it's predicting the future, but in fact there's not much that can happen that the person can't say, well, that's really what it predicted. You see, you look at this little feature here, something of that sort. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, turns out, had a dream of a very strange-looking statue. A statue in which the top was made of gold. That's not strange, no. If you're going to put any gold on the statue, you might as well put it up high off the ground where nobody can get to it. But silver down next, bronze in the middle, iron down further. That's reasonable, you know, make it stronger at the bottom. But then it really is a very strange statue because it's made out of iron and clay in the feet. This is where the term feet of clay, in fact, comes from. It's an allusion to this image in the Bible. But that's the strange being Nebuchadnezzar sees in his vision. And according to the book of Daniel, God gives Daniel the ability to know what the dream was. And so when he tells the king what the dream is, the king is much encouraged then that his interpretation of the dream is something that's for real. Well, let's look at what the features of the statue are and then at what the biblical material actually says is the interpretation of these. So we have here a prophecy set up in the form of a symbol, of a statue, which has a few actions going on with it, and then an interpretation of it. So we're in Daniel chapter 2 here. Those of you who may have a Bible with you want to take a look at it. On the one side, the features of what's going on, the statue itself, plus a little bit of action that happens after the statue has been described. And then on the right-hand side, I'll give you the interpretation given by the biblical account. I'm not getting into the question of what it really means. We'll get into that in a moment. But what the account itself says the features of the statue mean. Well, there is a statue. That statue is as I described it there. And then there's a little bit of action after the statue has been described. A large piece of stone, which it says is cut without hands. Doesn't explain more what that means. Comes flying down and hits the statue on its feet. And the statue falls over. It crushes the feet. And then I presume the stone rolls over it or something. It doesn't tell how exactly. So that it crushes the whole statue. And then the wind blows the pieces of the statue away. And the stone gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until that's all you see. So that's the statue and the action. And we're told both at the beginning and end of this interpretation that, in fact, this is a summary of what will happen in the future. Now, looking at the individual features, the head of the statue is of fine gold, highly refined, that sort of idea. And we're told by the account itself that this represents Nebuchadnezzar's own rule. He says, "You, O king, are the head of gold." As you go on through the account further, you see that that is not to be taken in the sense that it's only talking about the individual Nebuchadnezzar, but in fact it's talking about his empire. Talking about what we would call a Neo-Babylonian empire. Lasting, starting, I suppose, with Nebuchadnezzar's father, technically, Nabopolassar, then Nebuchadnezzar, and then running on for about two or three kings after that, depending on how you count Belshazzar, and ending then around 539 with the introduction of Cyrus the Persian. And so we're told that is the head of fine gold. You, he says, O king, are the head. So that part identification is quite clear. Secondly, we have the breast and arms made of silver, and the account tells us that after Nebuchadnezzar, there will be another kingdom, and it's not clear whether the Hebrew says that it will be an inferior kingdom or not. It uses a word which means lower. Of course, a lower kingdom might be an inferior kingdom, represented by the inferior metal, or it might just mean lower down the statue. It's not clear. So that's what the Hebrew says at that point. Then thirdly, a belly and thighs of bronze, verse 32 still, and we're told by the account that this is a third kingdom, third world kingdom. And fourthly, the iron legs. And this is a fourth kingdom, and here the iron is said to represent something. Perhaps the other metals represent something too, but it's said here that it's strong as iron. Then we come to the feet, part iron and part clay, and it appears that we're not into a fifth kingdom. Never have the statement, another kingdom, a fifth kingdom, anything of that sort. Just that this kingdom apparently becomes divided. And then lastly, the stone, which destroys the statue, we're told that is another kingdom, a different kind of kingdom. It's a kingdom set up by God in a different sense than the others are set up by God. Certainly the Bible in general and the book of Daniel in particular represent that God sets up all kingdoms that occur, but that does that providentially. He's going to do this one in some quite different way. So God sets up this kingdom. It's going to last forever, and its expansion to cover the whole world presumably sounds like it is a universal kingdom. You kind of get the impression that though the other ones sound rather universal. They're probably not universal, because this one, the stone, expands to fill the whole earth, whereas the statue is just sitting at one place. So some sort of world empires, but not technically perhaps covering the whole world. Well, that is the interpretation of it given by the book of Daniel. My suggested interpretation, which we're going to have to hassle with a little bit here a little later, is the one given here, that Neo-Babylonian Empire is the head of gold. The Medo-Persian Empire, which did in fact follow it in history, under Cyrus the Great, is the silver, and here we have the dates on the right, that the Greek Empire, established by Alexander the Great, and then followed up by his successors, is the bronze, and that Rome is the iron. Now, that is not accepted among people who do not believe in fulfilled prophecy. That identification is not accepted. It's true that this identification goes back as far as we have any independent statements about what the meaning of the passage was thought to be. Rabbinical views, views of late apocalyptic literature, make this fourth kingdom Rome rather clearly. But the liberal interpretation of the matter is that the book of Daniel was written in 168 BC, and therefore these kingdoms are not Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, but something else. We'll come back in a minute and look at that, but I want first of all to go on ahead and look at Daniel 7, which is, I think, agreed pretty well that it is a parallel passage. It's a passage discussing the same kingdoms, though it does it under a very different symbol. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees four, this Nebuchadnezzar is not involved here, Daniel sees four very strange-looking animals coming up out of the water. One of them looks kind of like a lion, it says, but strange lion, it's got wings. There's a little action with the lion. The lion is made to stand on its hind feet. It apparently comes out of the water walking on 4 feet with its wings, and something comes, somebody comes or something and stands him up on 2 feet. And it says, a human heart is put in him. See, action with the first animal. The second animal is a bear. This bear, we're told, is raised up on one side. I don't know exactly how to demonstrate a bear raised up on one side. I hesitate to get down here on the floor and make an attempt at it. But I presume it's standing on probably 3 legs with 1 leg raised. It's hard to imagine a bear with 2 legs raised, though I suppose it is conceivable. But raised up on one side, and it is gnawing on 3 ribs. Fourth animal is like a leopard, except for 2 very peculiar features. It's got 4 wings and 4 heads. 4 wings and 4 heads. And the fourth animal is never described as being like a something or another, so I happen to wound up with some kind of a little dinosaur. You'll forgive that. But I did this because, well, I'm not sure why I did this, but we'll let that ride. It has got teeth. They're iron teeth, it says. It has got horns. It's actually got 10 horns, but then an 11th horn shows up a little bit later. We're going to look at the details of this. And it's got claws, but the claws are made of bronze. So a very striking symbol, series of symbols, for what is going on here. There's a little bit of action here, too, as well as the action of the lion mentioned that he stood up and a heart is put in him, and such, man's heart. These various beasts come up out of the sea, we're told in verse 3, Daniel chapter 7, and the interpretation is 4 kings who will arise are represented by these 4 animals. Again, you see the same usage, I think, as you see in connection with Nebuchadnezzar. Although it says, you are that head, it turns out it's his empire that's that head, not just himself, although he's certainly the dominant person in that whole empire anyway. None of the other kings are hardly worth mentioning, I suppose his father, Nebuchadnezzar, but here it's 4 kings who will arise, but then as it goes on in this discussion, it's clear that they're using the term king as a synonym for kingdom, because they actually use the term kingdom later. Then we're given the information about the first animal, and no interpretation is given beyond what we've told there about the first king, about the 4 kings. The second, the bear raised up on one side, no interpretation given. The third, the leopard with 4 wings and 4 heads, no interpretation given. But when we reach the 4th beast, you get an interpretation. Mentioned is iron teeth, bronze, claws, and 10 horns. The 4th kingdom is said to be different from the other kingdom. It says that there are 10 kings associated with this kingdom in some sense. But then a 11th king shows up. A 11th horn grows up on the head of this strange animal. And that 11th horn somehow, I don't know whether it's got hands or not, rips up three other horns. So the animal starts out with 10 horns. An 11th one comes up. It rips out three, so it goes back down to 8. It's got 8 horns. And this king is said to be a different king, another king from the 10 kings, but apparently part of this fourth kingdom. He subdues 3 kings, 3 of the 10, so he gets some sort of a peculiar situation in which he is working with some simultaneous kings, apparently. And then it says a little bit about his further activities. Let's look at the further activities in each of these cases, both in the vision itself and its interpretation. You have remarks about the activities of this horn. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 8, it says, "While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and in a mouth uttering great boasts." So this 11th horn, which I'm not making an attempt to draw in this picture, has got eyes and a mouth. Very strange symbolism. And it says then further in verses 21 and 22, "I kept looking, and the horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom." And in verses 24 and 25, in the interpretation section, similar information is given. It's hard to really tell which of this, there's really not a clear distinction here made between interpretation and the features of the thing. "As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them. He will be different from the previous ones and subdue 3 kings. And he will speak out against the saints of the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hands for a time, presumably a year, times, at least 2 years, and a half a time." So that's the activities of this 11th king. Then we see some more action in this vision. You've seen 4 wild animals. Now you see 1 man, called a son of man, which is at this point, before the book of Daniel is written, apparently nearly a standard term for a descendant of a man, that is to say, a man. A man shows up on the scene, and God sets up thrones to bring these animals into judgment. He destroys the last animal, the 4th animal. He causes the other 3 to survive for a while, but with no kingdom. And he gives the kingdom to this fellow who is called a son of man. And the interpretation then of the passage tells us that God turns over the kingdom of the world to the saints of the Highest One, and that they will rule forever. They will rule universally. They will rule forever. Now, if we take these 2 prophecies, the prophecy of Daniel's wild beasts, the prophecy of Nebuchadnezzar's image, we find a strong parallelism. We find in both of them a prediction there will be 4 human kingdoms followed by a kingdom which God will set up, which will last forever. It would appear then that we are talking about the same kingdoms. None of them seem to say, well, we're leaving out kingdoms. I think that's right. Let's look then at the situation that we have here and look at different treatments of this that have been suggested by different people. One look at the traditional interpretation of the passage, which we see already in the rabbis, already in the late apocalyptic literature, that the first of these kingdoms is Babylon, standing at the time Daniel is prophesying. The second kingdom is the Medo-Persian Empire, when Cyrus the Great came in 539 and took over Babylon. He set up his own kingdom. That lasts till the time of Alexander, and he takes the kingdom in 331. He dies rather soon, but the kingdom in 2 large parts goes to 2 of his successors, and 2 other smaller parts, actually some divergence depending on how big a size parts you count. And that runs on down, at least in one segment, all the way down to 30 B.C., when Augustus Caesar defeats Mark Antony and Cleopatra, the last of the successors, if you like, to Alexander in the Egyptian kingdom, the last of the Ptolemies, and he takes over that thing, and the Roman Empire runs on from that time. This is the interpretation given traditionally. And this interpretation presents a very serious problem to those who do not believe in the supernatural. Because you would have something, no matter when you put the date of the book of Daniel, you can't put it A.D., too much material around it. It's clearly in existence by New Testament time. It's fairly hard to even put it this 168 date, which is quite consistent date used by those who do not hold the supernatural. But if it's dated anywhere back there, and the fourth kingdom is identified with Rome, you have a very definite prophecy, and a rather striking prophecy. You have a prophecy that the fourth kingdom, in its latter stages, will go into pieces. And these pieces will not cling together. Now, there have been two basic other interpretations, or a number of minor interpretations, but there have been two basic alternative interpretations that have been suggested here. One of them is the interpretation that you will find in International Critical Commentary by James Montgomery. In this interpretation, the second kingdom is the kingdom of the Medes, not the kingdom of the Medo-Persian, not the Medo-Persian Empire. And that way, the third kingdom is Persia, and the fourth kingdom is Greece, and you can make it come down to the time of the Maccabean period. And the theory is, a very common theory in liberal circles, that this is when the book of Daniel was written, that the book of Daniel thought that God was going to intervene right then, so he gives you beautiful predictions before that time because he's writing about the past. And then he says, God's going to come and bring it all to an end, and that doesn't happen because that's what he's predicting. And miracles don't happen. There's some very serious problems, though, with this particular construction. The major one is getting enough kingdoms before that time. You notice the wavy lines I put up there with the Medes between the Babylonian and the Medes, and the Medes and the Persians. That's because the writer in this assumption has to assume that the writer of Daniel did not know the history of this period, and the writer assumed that there was a Median kingdom between the Babylonian Empire and its destruction and the Persian Empire and its destruction. In fact, on the basis of the historical information we got, which is very clear, the Median kingdom, there was a kingdom, but it was never an empire, never had taken Babylon. The Median kingdom was taken by Cyrus the Persian as he rose to power, and it was incorporated as an equal part of the empire. So that it became the Medo-Persian Empire, in which Cyrus himself became not only king of the Persians, but king of the Medes. The Medes were made equal partners in the empire, and the empire went on to take the rest of the area. Well, he has to assume that there is a mistake about the situation back here. But that really does not fit with the rest of the discussion of the whole book of Daniel, because the whole book of Daniel consistently recognizes that it's the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. You have three or four times according to the law of the Medes and the Persians. You have a very definite prophecy in Daniel chapter 8, in which a couple of wild animals are used to represent world empires, and one of them, one animal, is said to be the Medo-Persian Empire, the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. In that particular prophecy, which would be interesting to look at, you get an opportunity, Daniel chapter 8, the twofold nature of the Medo-Persian Empire is represented by two horns on a goat, and one of the horns comes up first, but the other horn comes up second, so one grows up first by itself, and then the other one grows up second, and the second horn grows higher than the other. And apparently then it's intended to represent the Median part of the empire, which was earlier, was in existence before the Persian, and then the Persian part, which comes to importance later, but it grows bigger than the other, and functions that way. Well, then when you go back to look at our animals here, it's interesting that you've got a horn higher on one side, representing the Persian section of the Medo-Persian Empire. Here you've got a bear, the second animal, raised up on one side. Looks like you're using the same sort of idea of a level and a side to represent a different kingdom. So there is some difficulty then in treating the second of the animals as the Median Empire, but not the Persian Empire. It gets even worse when you get to the third animal, because the third animal has a very definite fourfold feature about it. Quite pronounced. It's not just four wings, it's four heads. Four heads, four wings. Very definite fourfold feature. But Daniel chapter 8, which has the two animals representing the world empires, says that the animal who destroys this goat with the two different size horns is a ram, and he has one horn in the middle of his head which is broken off just after he destroys the other animal, and four horns grow up. And we're told in that vision that he represents the kingdom of Greece. The one kingdom of Greece represented by one animal having first one horn and then breaking into four. And here we see definitely a fourfold animal. And the suggestion then is that the context of the passage itself requires that in agreement with Daniel 8, it be Greece, not Persia. So Montgomery's construction, which is intended to remove the prophecy, based on an assumption of a date of Daniel, to do that very thing, actually runs aground rather badly in the four animal prophecy, where the second animal has a twofold feature about him, and the third animal very definitely has a fourfold feature about him, and this twofold and fourfold feature are reiterated in Daniel chapter 8 with two other types of animals, and they're named in that place. They're named, this is the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, this is the kingdom of Greece. So this one really does not work, even though it's made by a competent man. You would have to assume that you have some kind of division, different authors or something of the book of Daniel, or something of that sort. He's really, essentially, he's trying to explain away the material. A much earlier attempt was made by an anti-Christian fellow named Porphyry, early centuries AD. And his attempt was not to split the Medo-Persian Empire, but to split the Greek Empire into Alexander and his successors to produce the same result. Your major problem here is that in Daniel chapter 8, we have this one animal representing the Greek Empire. It has a single horn, which we're told represents a single king, and it's broken and replaced by the four horns, and it says his empire will be split with four winds. So his splitting right here between Alexander and his successors, again, runs aground on the prophecy of the four beasts, where the one beast has got the fourfold feature about him, and that's the third beast, not the fourth beast, you see. Say if it were the successor, you know, if that had the fourfold feature about it, but it's not the fourth beast, it's the third beast that has got the fourfold division to it. But there's certainly nothing fourfold about Alexander. So it's his successors that you have this scattering of the empire to the four winds. So the suggestion here is that when you really sit down and work through the context of this passage, you find out it does seem to carry down into the New Testament period. And rather strikingly, it suggests something then about the end, the latter part of the Roman Empire, that it already has some splitting problems that don't have to do with its destruction by God's kingdom. Remember, God's kingdom comes down and smashes the feet and then becomes the worldwide kingdom. But here we already see something of a very strange sort. We are told that the feet of this image are iron mixed with clay. The clay is said to be brittle, the iron is strong, and that we are told in the passage this represents a mixture of strength and weakness in the empire. We're told that it has something to do with the mingling of the seeds of men. Apparently some kind of a problem of different races or something of that sort. Well, when you actually look at the Roman Empire, you find that it was not taken by another empire, but that barbarians came in from the north. I guess I'm related to some of those barbarians, but that's the way it goes. Began to mingle with the Romans. The Romans began to have more and more difficulty holding the empire together. It splits a couple of different times, but a final split near the end of the 4th century, I believe it's 395 if my memory serves, and then we usually hear that the Roman Empire collapses in 476 AD. And you say, well, the Roman Empire is gone. Can this have been fulfilled? The Roman Empire is not supposed to disappear according to this prophecy. It's supposed to be replaced by God's kingdom. Well, interesting. Is the Roman Empire gone? Well, it's true that we do not have one unified empire ruling over all that area. But in fact, the prophecy itself has mentioned a disintegration, has mentioned a mingling in the feet of iron and clay, a brittle part and a strong part that has something to do with the mingling of the seed of men. My suggestion, in fact, is that one can argue rather well that the Roman Empire is still alive in the sense that the book of Daniel suggests. The date for the fall of the Roman Empire is not, in fact, the fall of the whole empire. It's 476, it's the fall of the Western Roman Empire. The Eastern Empire continues on. There's actually a split back here, which is not drawn on this map. The Eastern Roman Empire continues on until the Turks take the empire in 1453. By that time, the Russians have adopted certain imperial titles. The Tsar or Tsar of Russia is merely the Russian word for Kaiser, Caesar, Emperor. So it's not too hard to see what the Emperor of the Russians thought he was. The other part of the Eastern Roman Empire is replaced by the Ottoman Empire. Both of those run all the way down into the First World War. The Russian Empire collapses early in the year 1918. Well, let's see, I may be off a year. I think it's 1918 or 1917. The Ottoman Empire collapses with the war. In the West, however, you have had again and again and again attempts to restore the Roman Empire. 800 AD, the Pope crowned Charlemagne Emperor of the West. It does not really last beyond his own life. When he dies, it is split to his children. Just before 1000 AD, Otto I is crowned Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And although many wags have said it was not holy, it was not Roman, and it was not an empire, yet the fellow did have the title emperor. It's true that he had to be elected, and that certain parts of the empire did not always do what he wanted. But the Roman Empire had trouble with that various times, and they were even in worse shape than election. The army used to decide on the emperor, and quite often it was the Praetorian Guard. So you certainly can't do anything with that. The Roman Empire runs from before 1000 AD, all the way down to 1805, when it is destroyed by Napoleon, who just puts it out of existence. The land still remained there. And Napoleon sets himself up as Emperor of the French. His architecture suggests very strongly that he intended himself to be a replacement for Caesar, a revival of all the Roman architecture. His nephew, Napoleon III, reigns for even a longer period of time, though not quite as spectacular a reign, later in the century, still in the 19th century. Meanwhile, Germany is beginning to get things together, and they adopt the term Reich, which basically means empire. Seems to sound like a replacement for the Roman Empire. They adopt the term Kaiser for their ruler, which is in fact the close as I know, the proper pronunciation in Latin of Caesar from ancient times anyway. And you have then the Second Reich under the Kaisers Wilhelm, and then a break of some years, and the Third Reich under Hitler. So you would certainly have to say that coming up to our very time, you have had continual attempts by men to restore the empire without success, but it is remaining in a segmented situation. Parts of it are strong, parts of it are weak. The idea politically of empire has not vanished. Nor has the culture of Rome vanished. The common law of most of Europe is Roman common law. Nor has the empire vanished religiously. Certainly rather drastic changes occurred late in the Roman Empire when Christianity was adopted as the state religion under Theodosius, rather than the various pagan forms that existed before that time, but that's certainly before the destruction. That's back 75, 80 years here. So that's already in existence before the end. That culture is continued on down. Certain even of the pagan titles are continued. The early emperors were high priests of the Roman religion, and they therefore had the title of high priest, which is rather unusual in the Roman religion. It means chief bridge builder. Pontifex Maximus. Somehow, it's difficult to say exactly how it happened, but Constantine, when he adopted Christianity, at least nominally, he decided that it wasn't good to have a pagan title, and so he abandoned the pagan title. Just how it happened that the Bishop of Rome picked up this pagan title and began to use it, I do not know offhand, but that's in fact what happens. So there is a religious system today which claims to be a continuation of the empire in its religious sense, and the fellow has even adopted that feature and several others that go back into the previous period. I've left on communism up here at the end in Russia as a continuation of the Russian Empire, certainly so politically. I don't know that anyone has adopted the title Caesar. They certainly would like to reconquer those areas. That's fair to say. So I think we can say that in agreement with what the statement is made here, that we have this division into the iron and clay parts of the feet. Indeed, the Roman Empire is still alive, and that statement of Daniel is quite satisfactorily fulfilled. And yet, even putting the book of Daniel in 168 BC, how could a person have foreseen? One, that there would be no empire to take over this whole area as the Roman Empire begins to disintegrate. It continues. You don't have something else come in and replace all of this. Several very serious attempts to do it. The Muslims made a very strenuous attempt to take this whole area. They even got into the middle of France. 100 years after they started, they were turned back. Certainly a number of other attempts have been made to retake this whole area by groups from outside, but have never really quite succeeded. That the Middle Eastern area would not see a 5th, a 6th, a 7th, an 8th empire until the end of the age. This passage predicts then that we will come to the end of the age one day, that this particular empire will continue in its fragmented state until those events occur. You get some picture from the horns, the beast and such, that there will be a person who tries to put it together in the last days. And I'm not going to attempt to go into that. But the points I want to look at here of fulfillment is a statement made certainly no later than 168 BC, I'd put far earlier than that myself, which predicts that from that point, the Middle East will be dominated by only 4 empires until God intervenes. And they are spaced in a rather peculiar way. The one of them lasts from Daniel's time to 539, about a total of 60 years. One of them lasts from 539 to 331. 200 years. One of them lasts from 331 to 30 BC, 300 years. And the other one has been lasting 2,000 years. So a prediction, you know, you would have expected, well, this one lasted that long, this one lasts this long, this one lasts this long. Well, the fourth one will last about the same order of magnitude. But in fact, it's lasted a full order of magnitude longer than the other one has. So I think we do have a very striking fulfillment of prophecy in this example. Tonight, then, we've tried to look at 3 prophecies, all of a rather unusual nature. One of them, Israel would be set aside until the end time. And the setting aside would mean no governmental identity, no Sinai religion, but no idolatry. And indeed, that very thing has been true from 135 A.D., let us say, to be on the conservative side, till 1948. And yet the prophecy says it won't last forever. Afterward, they will return. And then it does say some other things will happen beyond that point. That Israel, in fact, has maintained its identity. It has followed these very details. And yet Hosea could not have been written later than about 150 B.C., when we certainly have manuscripts of this material. King Jeconiah would be cursed, that his whole line, the line through which presumably the Messiah would have been expected to come, the Davidic royal line, was cursed, and yet somehow that would not prevent the Messiah. The New Testament has an explanation which serves quite a few other purposes too, that Jesus was born of a virgin, and that his father, through whom this line comes, was merely an adoptive father, and therefore he is not a descendant through this line, and yet he would have a legal right because he's adopted and a son has the legal rights of his parents. And thirdly, that the great world empires would be particularly numbered, that they are characterized by a number of things, and these things we could not prove are real predictions, until you begin to look at the Roman one, and then you do see a continuation up until the end times. You see a fragmentation, which things indeed have been true to date. All of these prophecies have an unfulfilled aspect as well as a fulfilled aspect. They say that there is a time coming when God will intervene yet in history, that he will call a halt, in a sense, to man's activities. He will himself bring Israel back to himself. They will recognize David, their king, which I understand is the Messiah, that he will somehow be a descendant of David, and presumably a descendant of Jeconiah, and yet not cursed, and that he will bring an end to the world empires. This, I think, should be something to cause us to think very carefully about these matters. Is there a God? Is there one who is in control of history? If there is one in control of history, could he demonstrate it to us some way? My suggestion is, in fact, we have a demonstration here. This is not all the data that exists in this area, but I've chosen these three prophecies for this evening. If there is a God, and he chooses to intervene, we should be very concerned how we stand with him. What sort of situation is he going to require? What does he want out of us? Or does it make a difference? No? Well, how do you decide whether it makes any difference? You can say, well, the kind of God I would like to have, it wouldn't make any difference to him how I got along with him, you know? But that doesn't happen to be the kind of God presented by the material from which we've gotten this these predictions. We've got to be very careful in adoptions of religion, in our selection of a religion, that we're not selecting a religion on the basis of what we like, but that we select a religion on the basis that this seems to be at the basis, on the basis of the information I've got at this point, the data I've been able to look at this point, this seems to be the religion that evidences itself as really being true. I would urge you to do that very thing. From what I know about the Bible, it would be a very dangerous matter to assume that it doesn't make a difference. There's a lot of people who don't like it, but I like a little wager that was set up by Pascal. You may have heard of the fellow, a rather well-known mathematician living in France several centuries back. He said, I'm paraphrasing, he said it in French anyway, he said it's a dangerous thing to ignore religions that say the consequences are disastrous for rejecting them. And the religion as it happens, as far as I can tell, it's a very surprising thing, the religion with the most disastrous consequences for rejecting it is Christianity. You think about the religions that exist, even the heresies that have been developed off of Christianity, almost invariably the change they will make first is to remove the doctrine of hell or to tone down the doctrine of hell. Whether they make it hard to get in hell, as some groups have done, or whether they say there isn't any, or whether they replace eternal torment by annihilation, or whether they just say, the kind of God I like wouldn't do that. Well, the kind of God you like might very well not do that. But there was a fellow one day, he wanted to buy the Brooklyn Bridge. So he went to Brooklyn and walked up to several people. He tried to get prices from them on the bridge. One fellow had an outrageous price. Millions of dollars he wanted. This illustration is not a true illustration, by the way. But several other people gave him a much better offer. He wondered, you know, which he should choose. Well, it turns out that the fellow who had to charge it one of the outrageous price, he actually had the deed to the Brooklyn Bridge. Whereas the other fellows were giving a bargain price, but they didn't have the deed. They didn't have the right to the bridge. And so the lesson there is, if you want to buy the Brooklyn Bridge, you don't buy it from the guy that gives you the best price. You buy it from the fellow who owns the bridge. Because that's the only way to get a clear title to it. Well, in religion, you don't select the religion you like. That's like buying the bridge at a bargain price. But when you die, you find out that God doesn't exist. Well, it'll be all right if I find out that God doesn't exist. No, that God doesn't exist. You need to choose the religion that is true. And the only way to test that is to see if there are evidences. Tried to suggest some. So I warn you very much against ignoring evidence, either for emotional reasons. If such a God exists, I wouldn't want to serve him anyway. I'd rather spend eternity in hell. Well, for goodness sake, think about that a little bit. You would not have a chance to change your mind, perhaps, once you're there. And ignoring it is not a very safe sort of matter. There's another alternative, and that is to explain the data away. That can be done with any data. That is not even a matter of deductive proof that you can't explain away. You can refuse to believe in logic. We're not talking about deductive proof here, though. We're talking about inductive evidence. Inductive evidence can always be ignored. The inductive evidence that a light is red can be ignored, and you may find out that you made a mistake after you've been run over by a trailer truck. But data can usually be ignored for some period of time, and you don't know what the consequences will be. All data can be explained away by maneuvering definitions, by wondering whether that's what it means, by adopting some explanation that you've seen somebody give. But it's a dangerous thing to do because you don't know that Christianity isn't true. You at least owe it to yourself, if not to anybody else, to examine the whole matter very, very carefully. I mean, I can assure you that Christianity is true, but many other people can assure you that other religions are true. You've got to investigate yourself. The things that really count, we like to check on ourselves. And rightly so. Rightly so. And there's a third alternative reaction to the matter. That is to say, well, I can't decide. Can't make up my mind. Don't know what to believe. I'm not going to decide. I'm not going to decide. Well, here you hit another very thing that people don't like about Christianity. And that is Christianity, as presented in the Bible, makes it very clear that not to decide is in fact to decide against. That you have to do something to be right with God. What you actually do doesn't make you right with God. You have to concede that his estimate of your character is correct. We aren't what we ought to be. Everybody will concede that. But of course not. I make a mistake now and then. I do a few things I ought not to do. The Bible's much more drastic thing than that. It says our whole tendency is to want a different God, prefer for ourselves to be God if we can arrange that, to want to have other people keep moral standards, but we don't want to keep them too much ourselves. We want to be able to judge others. I mean, we may not go around judging people, but the first time somebody rips off something that you own, you suddenly decide that you do like property rights a little better than you thought before. Well, we find that double standard in every one of us. We want to be the judge. We want to make the laws. We want to be the one to test everyone else. The Bible says that, in fact, is an attempt to take God's place. And it's a sign of our whole desire to turn away from him. Everybody wants to be the grand exception in the moral nature of the universe. God says there aren't any exceptions in the moral nature of the universe. Not even myself. Not even God makes exceptions in the moral nature of the universe. But he has made a provision that will straighten up this problem for us. We can be changed to be what we'd like other people to be and which we'd like to be ourselves. But God can't just do that. God can't just do that. God is really concerned about truth. He's really concerned about righteousness. And he really is the moral governor of the universe. He can't just say, well, that other stuff that you did back then, I'm going to forget about that. He can't do that. He cannot do that and be righteous. He cannot do that and be just. But God made an arrangement by which that would be paid for by himself. God himself would take the consequences of man's sin. We're told in Scripture that God is more complicated than most philosophers and many people through history have thought that he is, that we can only understand one being with one personality, or at worst, a schizophrenic being of some sort that has two conflicting personalities within themselves, and we don't know what their relationship to the person is and all that. The biblical picture of God, that there is a three-personality nature, and yet they don't disagree about anything. We'll have a communion among these beings. That one of those agreed, chose to himself take the punishment. Can't do that as God. He actually became a man. He is a man, live the kind of lives we ought to have been living and never have, so that his obedience could be credited to our account. He died a death of a sort that we couldn't die, because he could take an infinite amount of suffering in a finite length of time as God, so that if we trusted in him, that suffering would take the place of the punishment we deserve for sin. And on that basis, he can be just and yet declare righteous men who were sinners. A arrangement by which God is going to make us something different than we are, and he begins to do that from the very moment that you say, all right, God, I give up. I concede that I am the way your word says, that I'm not what I ought to be, and that if I were judging myself from a impersonal point of view, you know, if I could step out of myself over here and say, look at that terrible character with all of those attitudes and such, I would agree that your judgment of me is right, and that I ought to have these punishments. And if we would cast ourselves upon him and say, I trust in what your son has done, then he will change us. He will begin to work inside of us in a way that's not spectacular. You don't see any kind of light coming out the back of your head or things of that sort. But you begin to see changes in attitudes. And the people around you begin to see changes in attitudes and in actions which come out of our attitudes. And we understand that what God has done is he has applied Christ's obedience to that account that we have left empty all our life. He has applied Christ's death to take the place of the punishment we'd otherwise deserve. And he's changed us inside to begin to make us to move back towards what he would intend us one time to be. That's the offer of the gospel, the good news, which men have been proclaiming for nearly 2,000 years. It's good news and it's bad news. It's bad news that the only way to have acceptance with God is for your whole lifestyle to change, your whole attitude towards him and towards other people. You can't even change it yourself, but he's willing to change it for you if you will turn over yourself to him. If you will concede that you are, as the Bible says, that our tendency is to move away from the God that exists, to dislike him, to want him to be different, then he will change us. And that's what I would ask you tonight, to consider this very carefully. Christianity is true. A person who just walks in the first time and hears this for the first time, I don't expect you to take my word for it in one hearing. I'm not going to press you to make any decision, anything of that sort. I would press you that we don't know how long we're going to live, and that if the Bible is right, there's a great disaster waiting for you when you die if you trust in Christ. But I realize a person has to think through these things. A person has to consider the evidence. I would urge you to begin considering the evidence. Thanks.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania. Zip code 19440.